Okay, meeting will come to order for Governmental Operations and Veterans Affairs today on March 10th. And we do have a quorum now. Approval of minutes, Representative Sheldon Johnson.
I'd like to move the minutes forward today.
Thank you. Representative Sheldon Johnson moves approval of the minutes of the meeting of Wednesday, March 9th. Any discussion? All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Thank you. Members, we have four bills up today, one of which was the Hoppe bill from yesterday that we spent quite a bit of time on. You do have something in your packet from Mark Shepherd about three of the four bills where it identifies which sections of the bills relate to governmental operations. We hope to keep to those sections today so that other committees can deal with their appropriate areas. And so the first bill up is House File 945, Representative Earhart's bill. And Chair will recommend that House File 945 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation Policy. And Representative Earhart, I understand you have the A1 amendment. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, we're not going to do the amendment today because it's more appropriate in the Transportation Policy Committee.
Okay, thank you. So I don't see any other amendments. We do have the House File 945 bill before us. Representative Earhart, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is the Department of Transportation housekeeping bill. When you say housekeeping, this is where MnDOT sweeps everything under the rug to make things clean. So here we go. We are. I'm going to let the member of representative of MnDOT do most of the housekeeping on this bill. And outside of the fact that we are going to be further dealing with this in the Transportation Policy Committee, I will call on Eric Rudine from MnDOT to explain the housekeeping elements here. Thank you.
Mr. Rudine, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Eric Rudine, MnDOT Government Affairs, and I'll just cover those sections of the bill, as you said, that deal with the relevance in this committee.
Thank you.
Sections 3 and 6 deal with an expedited process for adopting stated operations rules, and there's a process already in Minnesota statutes in Chapter 14 for expediting rules. And we'd like to use that process. We think it could save us up to a few months for some very technical rules that we adopt with our county and municipal partners. And we revise these rules every 2 to 3 years. They deal with the design standards for our state aid highway systems and street systems. And we think that the process that's already set up in Chapter 14 would allow us to save some time. And we do partner with cities and counties in this process very extensively. And our staff can only remember one request for a public hearing since the 1980s. And certainly if there was a controversial rule or something, we could use the more lengthy procedure. But since these are highly technical and have heavy involvement from local governments already, we think it's appropriate to use the expedited process. So those are in Sections 3 and 6 of the bill. Section 3 deals with the county system, and Section 6 is the municipal state aid street system. Sections 4 and 7 of the bill would shorten the comment period for variances from state aid rules. Section 4 is the county variance, and then Section 7 would be the municipal state aid street variance. And we feel it's appropriate to shorten the comment period because, as you know, the state register is published electronically now. Variance requests must be in the form of a county board or city council resolution per Minnesota rules. And so when these requests come to us, they've already had extensive discussion at the local level, and the local governments have worked with their residents. And again, MnDOT state aid staff can only recall one time when interested parties provided input to the variance committee, and that input was in support of the request of the variance. And then there's section towards the back of the bill, section 14, which deals with the commuter rail coordinating committee. And this coordinating committee has been in existence. There are actually two. There's one for the North Star corridor and one for the Red Rock corridor. And these groups provide input to the commissioner on planning and coordination of commuter rail efforts. And we would exempt the commuter rail coordinating committees from the provisions of Minnesota Statutes 15.059, which provided that all advisory committees sunsetted on June 30th, 2003, unless otherwise exempted. And as I said, we do have two committees meeting at this time, and we certainly would like those to continue. So those are the sections of the bill that deal with this committee. There's something at the very end, which is just a reconstruction to the revisor, section 17, but I'd be happy to take any questions on those sections or if you have questions about other provisions in the bill as well.
Questions from members? Mr. Rudine, you talked about shortening the time where people could put in some information about their opinions on these issues. What do you do for outreach to try to let people know that they have an opportunity to do so? Mr. Rudine?
Madam Chair, we work extensively with our local government partners, and so we, in most situations, it's really them who do the outreach to their residents, because these are county roads, county highways or city streets, and so they would work with their residents. And we do administer the state aid program, which, as you might know, is set up in the state constitution. County state aid highways receive approximately 30% of the highway user tax distribution fund. City municipal streets in cities over 5,000 receive approximately 10% of those funds. And so we do administer the programs and help the locals administer those programs, but it's more likely that it would be the local governments that do the outreach.
Questions from members?
Madam Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Madam Chair and our guest here, I just wanted to ask about lifting the sunset under Section 14 that you talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And just wanted to ask you, are there specific actions that have been taken by the committee since that date, and are there some kind of what is the legal effect if there have been some actions that have been taken? Are we then ratifying actions that have been taken, or what's the legal status of those actions that have been taken in the meantime?
Madam Chair, Representative Blackwing, these are coordinating committees. They serve an advisory role, so I'm not aware of any actions that they've taken that be ratified. That language that you see in section 14 on the effective date, which is page 12, lines 16 through 19, that language was actually added by the revisor's office, and it was the revisor's office that brought this to our attention, that this committee was subject to section 15.059, saying that it had expired in 2003, and it escaped our attention, and so that's why it's in the bill this year. As I said, I'm not aware of any actions that they've taken that would need this language, but the revisor's office felt it was separate language to include in the bill.
Thank you.
Other questions? Is there anybody from the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Earhart, final comment before we vote on your bill.
Well, I certainly appreciated a positive vote, Madam Chair, so we can move this to the Transportation Policy Committee, and then solicit that from all of you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Chair renews the motion that House File 945 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Transportation Policy. Any discussion? All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and bill is passed to Transportation Policy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Earhart. Okay, next up is Representative Beard, House File 1460, And members, this bill is not listed on your sheet from Mr. Shepherd because it's considered that the whole thing basically is open to our committee purview. Representative Beard, would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I would like to move House File 1460 and recommend it to pass to the General Register.
Representative Beard moves House File 1460 go to the General Register. And Representative Beard, you want to talk about the A1 amendment?
I do, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I do have an author's amendment called the A1 amendment. I would like to sit here and tell you that it's an innocuous little amendment. I'd just like you to pass it. But I did that to you a couple of weeks ago, so I'm going to actually talk about this amendment for just a moment.
Thank you.
Most of what you see, Madam Chair and members, is technical stuff, except on page 2, I want you to note that in the middle of the page, we clarify the relationship, and this will be covered in more detail in a PowerPoint presentation in just a moment. But in order to put this bill in the shape I'd like for discussion, I would like you to know that in the middle of that page, we're going to talk about it clarifies that all mechanical and electrical subcontractors, even when they're a named member of a design build team, which we'll get into in a moment, they must competitively bid all subcontracted work. That's a concern some folks had. We just wanted to tamp that down and correct that by adding this part of the author's amendment, basically between lines 16 and 24. Now, if you turn over to the page 3, lines 2, 3, and 4, to the extent practical, the commissioner must give notice to representatives of targeted group businesses designated under section 16C.16. Although it's my belief and the folks who put this bill together that provisions of state law that require targeting a certain kind of work or certain amount of work to certain targeted business enterprises, women-owned and minority enterprises, in order to just buttress that and clarify it even more, we are going to put it in this bill in the form of this amendment. And there's several other technical and clarifying changes. Madam Chair, with that, I'd like to move the author's A1 amendment. Happy to stand for questions if there are any.
Questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, Representative Beard renews his motion on the A1 amendment. All in favor of that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and amendment is adopted. Okay, Representative Beard, your bill as amended is before us. Please present the entire bill.
And thank you, members. I'm going to make a few brief comments, and I'm going to invite two expert witnesses to the stand here to join me, and they will go through a PowerPoint presentation. However, the design-build concept is not new. 42 other states already do what we're asking for statutory authority to do here today. For the past several sessions, actually, we've had versions of this bill in front of us. They've been somewhat controversial, I'll just be honest with you. But thankfully, the folks who put this bill together came together and I think worked out most of the concerns and the details. And so the bill we have in front of us today, 1460, is the culmination of that work. Basically, the Department of Administration from the state of Minnesota, the University of Minnesota, and the Minnesota State College and University System, MNSCU, have asked that we put this tool in their toolbox, so that when they're putting big projects together, and you know we've got a whole boatload of bonding money going to these three systems this year, so I'm not sure that it'll actually apply, oh, by the way, in this bonding cycle. But going forward, where this kind of design build or job ordering or construction manager at risk, which we'll all define here in a moment, where these tools make sense, we want to allow these administrations and these state agencies to actually use this process primarily to respond quickly to needs that may arise. Occasionally, we can even attest that they save money, but I got to tell you right up front, this is not primarily a money-saving thing. It's a time and governmental utilization-saving thing. That'll become more clear whenever the professionals explain it. We're going to get faster delivery of projects. We're going to allow the public owners the choice of delivery systems to meet the needs that they have. And I think I can just talk about two brief things. We all remember September 11th, that horrible day. The Pentagon was rebuilt in record time using a design-build system. We did not have to design it, bid it, and rebuild it. The Pentagon Department of Defense went right to work as soon as the forensics teams released the building after the crime was committed, and because we had to put several hundred thousand square feet of the Pentagon back into play. if we'd have had this tool in our toolbox a couple years ago here, I think in Representative Seifert's district, there was a pretty nasty fire at Southwest State that took a building out of play for a couple of years. Had we had design build, the administration of Southwest State or MNSCU could have been right on that building as soon as the firefighters were done and put that building back into utilization on that campus. As it was, we had to do it the traditional design, bid, and build way. So members, if we're going to call Mr. Bob Cutchell and Mr. Bob DeBruin to the stand now, and they're going to walk through this PowerPoint presentation that hopefully will explain in greater detail why this is a good thing for us to do here today, and then we'll stand for questions when we're done. Bob and Bob, can you come up here? There'll be just a few moments of technical monkey business while they get these things plugged in. Bear with me, I appreciate it.
Everybody has a handle? It's like you're ready there. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bob DeBruin. I'm an architect, past president of AIA, the American Institute of Architects of Minnesota. And with me is Bob Cutchell, who represents the build side of this equation. I represent the design side of this equation. Behind us, we also have the three owner representatives that we are talking with and are part of our coalition today, the Department of Administration, the University of Minnesota, and the MNSCU.
Welcome.
Okay, while we're warming up the PowerPoint, we've been at this for quite a long time. 1998, I think, was the original inception of our efforts. And I think we finally brought together a broad-based coalition of people, including the owners in this equation this year. And we think we've come up with a bill that makes sense. We hope you agree with that. Our overall objective today is simply to allow the use of alternative delivery systems for public owners. Let me reiterate, it's not a requirement that they use them. It just simply makes these tools available to those institutions.
Madam Chair, if we could have the page up here to show us the button to push the turn this thing on, it'd be a good deal.
Okay, we'll see if we can work on that. Representative Pearson. Mr. Cashel, could you again, on your introduction, could you again, who do you represent? What? You're not with the architects, you're with whom again?
My name is Bob Cutchell, and as part of this coalition, there's a number of industry groups involved here. I'm representing the Design Build Institute of America, the local chapter in Minnesota here.
Okay.
I'm also, our company is an AGC member, but I'm not exactly wearing that hat as far as the coalition.
Okay.
But.
Thank you. That has gone around. I know members could follow from that until we get the system up.
You know what? If everybody has hard copy, we could just.
We'll work from that. Thank you.
Might be less distracting anyway. Sometimes these things are more troubling than worse. What we're talking about today is a bill that has three alternative delivery systems. And what we mean by a project delivery system is it defines the roles of the participants in a construction project, the relationship between them, the timing of events, and the practices and techniques of management that are used to effectively get the building built. Why Minnesota needs this bill As I stated earlier, we think that it allows the public owners a choice of delivery systems to meet specific project needs. In many cases, it results in a much faster delivery of those projects. Again, not a requirement, but an alternative. There's been a lot of history with these alternative delivery systems in the private sector, and substantial increase in use in both the public as well as the private sector over the past 25 years. As Representative Beard mentioned, 42 states currently allow design build in some form. And if you look at the diagram that shows the public procurement laws in the different states, you can see all of the ones in blue are where it's already allowed. And in the medium color, it's a limited use. And you see Minnesota is listed as a limited use state because currently the Department of Transportation has the ability to utilize design build and are quite successful with that. Representative Beard also mentioned on the next page the Pentagon project, which was a very successful project, so I don't need to reiterate that here. But based on 2004 information, the General Services Administration of the federal government uses the traditional method, design, bid, build, on 60% of its projects, construction management at risk on 20%, and design, build on the remaining 20%. The military also uses it very extensively. The next page talks about CMAR, that's Construction Manager at Risk. You didn't have a tendency to use acronyms. And design build are new for some Minnesota public entities, but as I said, not the DOT. This bill provides limitations, definitions on the usage of those alternative methods, and that will be described a bit later. The traditional method to deliver a building is design, bid, and build. The selection of both the designer and the contractor in that process is currently under state law. The State Designer Selection Board selects the architect to design the project. The documents are put together, and then those documents are bid by a contractor, and whoever has the lowest price gets the bid. Next page on a design-build scenario, the basic definition is that the owner contracts with a single entity to perform both the design and construction of the project under one contract. The benefits on the next page of that process are it's probably the fastest method of delivery possible in terms of getting a project built. There's a firm cost that's established early in the design process rather than waiting until the design is completed. The constructor has input during the design process, which we think is important and valuable. And there's a single source responsibility for the project, both design and construction, so you don't end up with the finger pointing as who's responsible for what. The selection process that the bill envisions uses the State Designer Selection Board, which is currently a board that's already in place. That board has been in place since 1974, 30-plus years of history. And we think from the standpoint of selecting professional service providers, it's done an excellent job. 4 years ago, a contractor was added to the list of members of that board, specifically in anticipation of the potential for these alternative delivery systems. As it's comprised right now, the State Designer Selection Board has an architect representative, an engineer representative, a representative of the State Arts Board, two public members, a representative of whatever user agency is going to be using the building, and, as I said, a contractor representative. Those are the people that are charged with selecting, in the current system, designers for all public-funded projects. The design-build alternative in this bill has a selection basis, two methods for selecting. The first method is a design and price-based selection, where the design builder, based upon the proposed design cost and schedule, puts together a fixed price proposal for the project. The second method is what's termed a qualifications-based selection. The design builder, in this case, is selected on the basis of having the best qualifications to both design and build the project. Now, in many cases where schedule is the absolute driver, the qualification-based selection process makes a lot of sense. It delivers it faster and the fastest method possible. I'd like to now turn it over to Bob to kind of complete the presentation, and if there are any questions, we'll take them at the end. Thank you.
Thank you. It's Mr. Kutchel, right?
I apologize for the technical difficulties. This is your worst nightmare coming true here. And
we're getting by just fine.
It's never happened before to me, but it's happening today. What we're on is the construction manager at risk. This page here is where I would like to begin for my part of the presentation. And how that system works, there are two separate contracts, as in the traditional design, bid, build. But the contractor, the CM, is the construction manager, is brought on very early in the design process, provides pre-construction services, bids out the trade contract work, which is about roughly 90% of the project value does get competitive bid out in this process, guarantees the cost, quality, and schedule of the project. This is a little different than construction manager agency, which is a delivery method that public entities use now, in that the construction manager under this delivery system is financially responsible for the project and the schedule and the quality, and that's not the case under construction manager agency. Some of the benefits of this delivery system, again, the constructor has input during the design process. It is faster than the traditional construction method, and there's a firm cost established early in the design process so that the owner knows what the project's going to cost before they expended tremendous amounts of money on design. On the selection process, the way this bill proposes to select construction managers is the agency using this delivery method would set up a committee of a minimum of three members, at least one of which has construction or design industry experience. The selection of the construction manager is based on qualifications and fees. And once again, you're really getting the management component of the contractor here. The trade contract work, which is the bulk of the cost, is handled on a competitive bid basis. The third delivery method in this bill is job order contracting, and that is geared towards small projects. Interested bidders are pre-qualified and enter into master contracts with the public entity, so all the paperwork is all done ahead of time. When a project does come along, it is competitively bid to a minimum number of contractors based on the size of the project, and the award of that goes to the low bidder. So it is very similar to the traditional competitive bidding process, but it's intended to expedite that process and make it go more quickly. The project size under this delivery method is limited to $250,000 or less. The benefits of job order contracting: it will be much faster than the current system. It will reduce administrative costs, and there's local contractors available to respond to the immediate needs of agencies. This is primarily geared for smaller projects that need to happen very quickly, and we're trying to take a lot of the administrative and red tape out of the process. On the next slide, the selection process, as I mentioned, is competitive bidding.
Did we talk about that?
Okay. Yeah. Just wanted to get someplace into the presentation here that we have engaged the National Association of Minority Contractors in this process, and they've had a couple of minor concerns with the bill that Representative Beard mentioned earlier. And we've met with them. We're in agreement in concept with them on what needs to happen. There's a couple technical things we haven't got worked out exactly how to work it into the bill, but I believe we have satisfied their concerns on that issue. The next slide here, and this kind of gets into the guts of what this is all about, is why do these delivery methods work better in many instances? And the first work is teamwork and communication are enhanced. What you have on any construction project is three really important entities. The three key entities are the owner, the designer, and the contractor, or the constructor. And if you go to the next slide, what happens is if you bring these entities together right from the beginning of the project, All parties have a clear understanding of the owner's goals. Communication channels are established early, and the designer and constructor work collaboratively to meet the owner's goals. In the traditional method, the constructor is not involved at all in the design process or dealing with the overall goals of the project. They're simply hired after the project is designed to go out and build it. The next sheet talks about the constructor involvement in the design process. And then if you could go to, there's a graphic showing some curves, and this would be much easier to see on a screen, and I wish I had a board right now to show this, but I will try and explain it the best I can. The vertical line, this is a time scale drawing on a typical project from left to right. Left would be the beginning of the design process. As you move through, that vertical yellow line is the start of construction on a project, and then you would go through to the very end, to the completion of the project. So it's a time scale on there. What that dark curved line is, it says cost influence, is the ability to affect the cost of the project. And that ability is very high in the beginning of the project. And as you begin to make decisions about different building systems, where you're going to locate it on the site, the type of structural system, the type of exterior skin, you make these decisions, you have made cost decisions at that point in time, and unless you're going to go back and start all over again, you have determined very much of the cost of the project. So that the time under the traditional system, when you get to the point where you're going to competitively bid the project, by and large, the cost of that project is fairly well determined because you've made all these decisions along the way. What these two other delivery methods allow, if you go to the top of this graph, you'll see three bars on there, one showing design, bid, build, which is the traditional. That shows when the different construction entities are involved in the process. And with design, bid, build, they don't get in until just before the start of construction. They bid the documents, they build it. With CM at risk and design, build, they're involved much earlier in the process. They're working with the owner to do cost estimates, constructability analyses, and different things that will allow the owner and the designer to derive the best value out of the project. So that's one of the key differences in these two delivery methods. If you go to the next sheet, there's two other things that happen typically in these delivery processes. Both of them allow for phased construction of the project, and the project cost is guaranteed much earlier. And if you'll go to the next sheet that has a graphic on it that shows, these are basically schedules on typically how these projects would work. The top one is the traditional method of how the project gets handled under design, bid, build. There's a design process. The project gets completely designed. You go out and bid it, and then you build it. And you don't really, that little vertical red line there, that indicates when you know for sure what the cost of the project is going to be. You have you don't know that until after the bidding phase. You'll have estimates prior to that, but you don't know that. In construction management at risk, you have a phase process where you typically issue different bid packages, and you can typically get a guaranteed cost out of your construction manager before the documents are completely done. Under design build, you can see it's a much more of a staggered phase process, and depending on which of the delivery systems you choose under design build, you can either get a guaranteed cost right up front at the start of the design phase or probably halfway through under the QBS method. So all of these allow for an earlier knowledge of the cost so that you can determine if a project is in budget or not. Moving on, and we're almost done here. Again, as we mentioned earlier, there's limitations on the use of these delivery systems. 5% of the total number of projects for the first year and then 10% thereafter. These are not intended to become the predominant delivery systems in the state. The agencies we've been working with have no intention of doing that, and this puts limitations on their use so that that they're only used when they need to be used. Limitations on job order contracting. There's no limitation on the number of projects under job order contracting, but the maximum project size is limited to $250,000. It's a size limit there as opposed to a limit on the number of projects. And again, the organizations who have worked to support this legislation and draft the bill as it is being presented to this committee are listed on the last two sheets of the PowerPoint here. And with that, I will open it for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for members? I know this is a lot to digest. Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can't I can't remember the specific place. I can't find it at the present time in the bill, but I recall after perusing it, it indicated that there would be a list of contractors. Who develops the list?
Mr. Cutchell?
Well, okay, that's on the different delivery methods. It's on job order contracts, and there is a list of contractors. That is pretty much open to anyone who wants to get on the list, as long as I believe they can bond a $250,000 project and they don't have a criminal record or something like that. There are some provisions about following state law and things like that. That delivery system is open to anyone who wants to get on there and who can bond the $250,000 project. The primary focus of that delivery system is to get all of the administrative and the paperwork out of the way ahead of time up front so you don't have to deal with it later.
Follow-up, Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair. What percent of the list from which they choose, the commissioner chooses, are Minnesota corporations?
Mr. Cutler.
Or does that vary from time to time or whatever? Maybe you could just give me a perspective in regard to that. I just wanted to see how this building project impacts possible jobs in the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Cutchell.
Madam Chair and Representative, I didn't get your
Dempsey?
Name. Dempsey? Dempsey, excuse me. There is no provision in the bill that deals with that issue. You do not have to be a Minnesota corporation.
Madam Chair, Representative Dempsey, I believe it would be like it is now under the traditional design bid build process. Pretty much the taxpayers are looking for a qualified company to give the best deal. And I don't know that we have any. There may be restrictions, but I don't think there are. And this bill does not purport to change any of that.
No. Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Next up, Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question is related to the limitations on delivery systems. We have 5% of projects for the first 2 years for both design, build, and construction management at risk, and then 10% of total projects thereafter. And I'm wondering, I think this sounds like a pretty good idea to do this. I've been involved in some things where I think it would have been very helpful to be designing along the way because you come across tank changes, and change orders are not a good thing in construction. My question is why do you feel the need for the limitations, and also how did you come up with the numbers?
Do you want to take that? I can. This was a pretty lengthy conversation, actually. And we looked at value, dollar value. We tried to find something that was reasonably straightforward and simple to define, number of projects. We also wanted to place some limitations on it so that it wouldn't be perceived as a carte blanche, go ahead and use these alternative methods for everything. We decided we'd be better off sticking our toes in the water, if you will, and seeing how it works. And then if it works extremely well, then maybe you can increase that limit. But it was kind of over a long period of time with all of the kind of owners involved in that conversation as to what made the most sense and was the simplest and most straightforward for them to administer.
Yes, Mr. Kessel.
Excuse me, could I respond to that also? These are new methods for some of the public agencies here, and they will need to change some of their procedures to deal with them. We felt a phased-in approach to that would make sense. There's also issues on the industry side also. There are, with the traditional delivery method, especially for contractors being the traditional design, bid, build, a number of them need to change their organizations also, and we're involved in the educational process to help them learn more about these new delivery systems so they'll be able to compete in that just like they've been able to compete under the design, bid, build.
Okay, we have three other members with questions. First up, Representative Mahoney.
I actually have a number of questions, but this is in reference to it goes along with Representative Dempsey's question on the $250,000 and under contractor list that you're talking about. Is there a minimum number of contractors on that list prior to it being able to be used? And my concern here is that you might get two contractors on the list, and you only use one or two, and all of a sudden a whole variety of contractors never even know the job is coming up, and they don't get a bid in. So is there any provisions, or do you have any plans, Representative Beard, to put provisions in that has to be a minimum of six or ten or a dozen contractors on that list before it can be used?
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, while they're thinking about what is already in state law, I know that in the job order process that works now, just depending on the size of the job, we are required by statute, I believe the existing statute, to have a minimum number of bids before we can award a job, pick one and award a job. So that there have to be, the bigger the job, the more there have to be. I think if it's actually $250,000, there have to be six bids or five bids, and it kind of steps down from there, four bids, three bids, and so on. There also is a group called the State Designer Selection Board that manages the selection process on the bigger jobs. I don't know if they'd actually apply to the job order method of delivering smaller jobs or not, but perhaps Mr. De Bruin can speak to that.
Well, currently they're not. I don't think we would anticipate that being the case. I think each of the user agencies and our three owners back here maybe can respond to that. It's to their advantage to have a large number of people, contractors, on that list so that they can have a tremendous number of potential bids on any particular project. There isn't any specific language in the bill other than for each level of cost, there are a minimum number of bids that are required. But in terms of generating the list, we've kind of left that, I believe, to the user agency, thinking that they probably know what's best given the circumstance.
Madam Chair, I do have a member or a representative from MNSCU that can respond a little more directly to the question.
Sure. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Bill Breifogel. I'm the Director of Construction Support Services for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. And one of the reasons this job order contracting is attractive to MNSCU is that we are very diverse, as probably most of you know, throughout the state. What we are trying to do in this particular part is give them another tool in a toolbox in that they can go out periodically and request contractors to submit and get put on a more or less local master contract list. The reason it's important for them is that as a small college or university, even as a large one, there's numerous things that can go wrong. Imagine even in your own house, you wake up one morning and notice that you have a leaky faucet or something else, and you need some immediate work. If that's over $50,000, they are required right now to go out, publicly bid that. This process allows that process to be done early and be put on a list, such that they can go out and reach somebody, have them come in off that list and say, give us a proposal to do the work. We need it done tomorrow. We don't want any other damage, further damage done to our facilities. So it would be our intent, as we would work through the process, that every college or university would have that capability to do it locally. We would obviously want to have as many people on the list, and we think we would have that. The state also does that statewide. We would do it locally. So that's how we would proceed going forward. If for some reason we do not have the minimum number, then we are required, and we would go out, and we would also look at doing it competitively. But we hope to do this paperwork up front to allow for the competition and bring those contractors on a list for us.
Follow-up, Representative Mahoney.
Well, Madam Chair, that's an awfully long answer to just know you don't have a minimum number of contractors on a bid list. And I would have suggested, if you guys had stopped fairly quickly, that you get a minimum number of contractors on the list. If you're going to do a $250,000 bid, you make sure that before you set that out, you've got 10 contractors rather than just your minimum of six, because you've outlined it in your bill where you have to have two, four, and six, depending on the dollar figures, and I read that. I'm just saying that you should have more contractors or a minimum number of contractors above and beyond the minimum number that you have in here. The other question I have is, in the bill and on job sites that I've been on, and I've done a few of these design bills, one of my bigger concerns is the how you get a concrete order, and the whole project really costs $450,000. And rather than taking the extra time, you go down your preferred contractor list and you separate out the sidewalks, which are $200,000, and you make that onto your under $250,000 bid, and you separate out the driveways. Although they are connected, they butt up right next to each other, they're on the same footprint of a building, the driveway is $225,000, so all of a sudden you're up to your $450,000, which kind of defeats some of the purpose of what Representative Beard is doing. I'm not asking for an answer to that particular question. I'm just pointing out some of the deficiencies in your bill, Representative Beard, and you might want to think about it as it moves along. There is another question I have that is even more specific here to your bill. You talk of this bill is effective the day following enactment. But everywhere in this bill, I read that you're talking about having a criteria established and rules made up. So could you please tell me, is this bill effective the day right after enactment, or does it have to go through the rulemaking process at the Department of Admin?
Representative Beard.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney and members, I don't see, really see the where it... let me put it this way. Rulemaking and education can't even start at the moment because of statutory prohibitions or prescriptions on how we do design, bid, build. If the bill passes the day it becomes effective, the very next day, we can start the transition. To start the transition now would frankly be illegal. So I guess I don't see it as a really big issue, but I see it as important to allow the agencies and the contracting associations that work with them to start the changes the day after this becomes effective, which really they would be presumptuous to do right now.
So
now perhaps our expert witnesses want to speak further to it. I don't know. Is that your question?
Just to your particular, just so I have some assurances from you, Representative Beard, because you've been very straightforward and upfront with most everything I've ever seen you involved with.
Most.
You're in well, we could talk about health care, but no, we don't want to go down that road. Your intent is not to supersede the rulemaking process if the Department of Admin determines that they need to go through a rulemaking process. That's your intent, that they would follow through with their normal process of making the rules and setting these criteria. Even if you've got them reasonably well laid out here, there's probably some need to go through that.
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, members, and Representative Mahoney, exactly. Again, if for admin to start that, absent this bill, would actually be against the law, is my contention. And I think it's important that it becomes effective the day after enactment, because perhaps not this bonding cycle, but the next one, we would like this tool to be in the toolbox of MNSCU admin and the University of Minnesota. And it's going to take time to change those rules and those procedures, and I certainly expect them to follow the process we have in Chapter 14, I believe, Representative Seifert refers to, in the rulemaking process, anyhow. Mm-hmm. So, yes, exactly.
Okay, we have four other members with questions. Next up, Representative Sheldon Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Beard, have you heard any opposition from other organizations, from groups, organizations regarding this legislation? I see it's been out for a while, and you have supporters clearly. Have you heard any significant statements of problems with it?
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, no, I have not. My door is open, and everybody knows that if you bring cookies to my office, I'll listen to anything. And I have had no opposition approach me about it. I hear a few rumblings around the water cooler, but no one's come forward.
Thank you. Okay, next up, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Beard, I got like Mahoney, or Representative Mahoney, excuse me, Representative.
I've been called worse, so I'm not worried about it.
I've got a number of questions. If I can start on the job order contracting, I didn't hear either one of the testifiers mention, but it looks like in the bill these are limited to the 5% and then is it by number of projects or by size? And I actually get two people back there nodding their head in different directions.
Okay, well,
I'd like
let's get something on record here. Who's going to answer?
Well, let me start with
Representative Beard.
Representative McNamara, as I understand the bill, it's actually the number of contracts that are involved. We didn't want to limit it to dollars. I imagine the administrative nightmare that would be. But actually, the number of contracts that are left during the year, we've put the self-limitation regarding contracts. Does anybody beg to differ at the table here?
Mr. Kutchel?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, was the question on job order contract? The limitations are different on the different delivery systems. On job order contracting, the only limitation there is project size of $250,000. So an agency could use this process on all of the small projects that they have on job order contracting. On design build and CM at risk, it's based on the percentage of the number of projects issued by that agency.
Thank you.
Representative
Beard, I've got concern about that. And then it'll follow with my next question. What types of projects will you use on the $250,000? You can just give me, besides a building addition, is it going to be planting trees on a job? What kind of projects would it potentially be?
Is it Mr. Breifel?
Madam Chair, Representative, how we would envision it would be primarily those quick turnaround projects. There would be small facilities maintenance projects. There could be leaking faucets, small amount of work throughout the campus. We wouldn't envision doing anything large in here, obviously, because we're limited to 250.
Representative McMurray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I wouldn't put a leaky faucet at $250,000. Anyway, my next point, you alluded to a time frame where you had the leaky faucet one day, you make a couple phone calls or something, and people get back to you. That put a shiver down my spine as somebody who's spent 28 years in the contracting business and bid openings. Are we throwing out the competitive bid situation? We've got a local person in Hastings, Minnesota, sitting at the vet's home that's making a couple phone calls and getting bids in different order. I got all kinds of spooky things going through my head when you were testifying.
Mr. Buffel, Madam Chair, Representative, no, there would be a process that they would have to come in. They would have to take, obviously, a look at what's required. There would be somebody from the college or university, typically a facilities person. We would highlight what the parameters of that project are, and then we would take a bid proposal from them. What that would allow us to do then is go straight from a bid proposal to more or less give them that notice to proceed because the contract, the master contract, is already signed.
Representative McMurray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would there be a time that they would deliver those proposals and a date, and would they be sealed to your local office?
Mr. Breifel.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, there would be. We would bring in as many of those we would want to at one point. We would have it at one point where everybody would show up so everybody gets the same information. All questions are asked and answered at that point, and then there would be a time, date certain where a proposal would have to be delivered back to the college or university.
Thank you. That's very good to hear, and I'm glad it's on record. Thank you, Madam Chair. And then one more, Representative Beard. I think as this moves forward, I've got real concern if we're going to allow 100% of job order contracting in this initial phase. I think I'm a very big supporter of design build. Been involved in projects that were design build that have come off terrific. You must realize if we speed up the time frame and a project's built as design build, that's the traditional method. In the last year, we potentially would have saved 8.5% on a project because of the price of steel and the price of concrete. But we here in state government absolutely want to get the best bang for our buck, and we want the local person at the local college to look like he's doing things right. I just am concerned that maybe this should have some percentage parameters on it as we move forward into this new area, and I hope wherever it goes next that Representative Beard, I can work with you. I am a co-author on the bill and would just like to put that on the record. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks, Representative Beard.
Thank you, Representative McNamara, for your concerns on this. This bill is moving straight to the General Register from here. However, it has yet to move in the Senate, and part of the reason is they're waiting for some things that like this to come up here. It will have to be conferenced, I'm sure, because I think there's some more language that the bill authors or sponsors would like to add concerning the minority contracting provisions. We have it probably 80% of the way where we want it to be, but I'm anticipating there'll be some language changes regarding that issue. If you need some things worked out with the job order contracting provision, well, the Senate's going to hear it, and I'm certainly going to be listening to what they have to say when this goes to conference, or we may just accept the Senate file if that seems to please the committee. I will just mention, oh, by the way, the job order contracting business, apparently the University of Minnesota has been doing something like this under their authority already and with a high degree of success. And whenever you're thinking about job order contracting, perhaps a leaky faucet isn't the best thing to think about for an example, because we have maintenance folks at the campuses that do a lot of the smaller stuff. But think about, for instance, a severe thunderstorm that blows down a bunch of trees or tears the roof off of a building. And, of course, we can't go through the 90-day bid process to get things fixed. Perhaps we need to bring some local contractors in to clean up the mess right away. But your point is heard and the message is heard. Well taken.
Okay, I have six members on the list. Next up, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Beard. I also am supportive of design build. I believe that's been used on the Highway 52 project in Rochester and very effectively. But I have just some questions about this bill. First of all, as a sort of a general comment, I kind of wish we weren't talking about three different things all at once. It makes it kind of confusing. It'd be better, I think, if we could, those of us who aren't really familiar with this area, if we could be looking at these three separate systems and discussing these separately. But be that as it may, I do have a question about this job order contracting, and I wanted to follow up a little bit on what Representative Mahoney was asking. And just to say, I had kind of the same concern that he raised about whether you could be breaking up projects into smaller pieces and fitting them under this job order contracting. I mean, I think this sounds like a good idea. I can certainly see the need for it. But I'm just wondering, is there any sort of protection against that being used inappropriately? Are there any guidelines for, you know, when is something one project that's $500,000 and when is it two projects that are $250,000 and how do you decide that? And then I'll have another follow-up.
Is it Mr. Breitfeld, you're going to answer? Okay.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Leaving. You do point out a possibility that the... it could lead to abuse. I will tell you right now is that we could do theoretically the same thing by keeping it under $50,000. Our response and our guidance to all the schools on how they're doing contracting right now is that a project is considered a whole project. We do not allow it to be broken up in bits and pieces simply to get under some dollar limit. So that is not our guidance to the school, and I would not anticipate that our schools would be looking for those sort of loopholes in this bill.
Okay,
follow-up, Representative Lee.
Thank you, but there's nothing in the bill that addresses that specifically, though, am I right?
Madam Chair, Representative Lee, no, there's not.
Okay. And then, Madam Chair, if I may...
Representative Lee.
Thank you. My other question went back to something that Representative Demmer had asked about the limits on the use of design-build, and... I wanted to ask about that from a slightly different perspective. I had assumed that those were in there because there was concern possibly that sometimes cost design build can be more costly, although I recognize that doing a project quickly can actually be a big saving. But, you know, you're potentially having a more expensive project when you don't design and then bid out. So I guess my question is, if that is part of the reason for doing this a little bit cautiously with these caps, and if you have any sort of sense of whether it will make some of these projects more expensive, I mean, is there any sense that are we potentially costing ourselves a lot of extra money to do this experiment, or are we potentially saving money? How does that break down?
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, as I was in the education process about this bill and being somewhat familiar with the design-build thing in Rochester, this tool that we're asking the legislature to approve is not for necessarily for saving money. It's for speed and effectiveness in many cases. And you'll notice that the caps are only for a few percent of the projects to actually go this route. Knowing how strenuous it is for MNSCU or the U of M or anybody to come here and ask for bonding money and having to compete for a pool of money that's on our state credit card, if you will, I think that the impetus is already built into the system for them to look for the most efficient, cost-efficient way to do a project. But if we do have some urgency, a fire, a tornado, a criminal act, where we have to move quickly, that is what this is designed for. This isn't designed to build all the buildings on the U of M campus from now forever with the design-build process. This is a tool to be used for extenuating circumstances, if I can put it that way.
Okay.
Follow me?
Yes, you can finish up. I have five other members. Representative Liebling.
Thank you. That does very much go to my question, but still, I just wondered, is there any sense, though, of how much additional it might cost, or is there just no sense of where that's going to fall out? And, you know, maybe having this sort of limited experiment is a good idea for that reason that we don't know.
Representative Baird.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling certainly is. And I noticed we've got 2 years at 5% before it steps to 10%. We do have 42 other states with this kind of experience, and I think I would encourage the authors who are going to make the same presentation again, or the bill sponsors, a better way to say it, in another week or two in the Senate to certainly be hearing your questions and having that information for those folks, too.
Thank you. Next up is Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. Representative Beard, you got a nice map here. And I just want to begin. I got a couple comments and questions. The GIS system has really done a lot for maps these days, and I like the looks of this one too. But I wonder, after the next election, will we be a red state or a blue state? That being said, Representative Beard,
Representative Olson,
you don't need to respond to that.
Thank you.
On page 11. If I understand this design bill correctly, and I appreciate being able to hear this testimony because I've never heard a thorough testimony on design build, and I've been long concerned about the process because I keep hearing that it's a good process. I keep hearing all of these different options are a great improvement, but I've really never seen the data to confirm it. And it concerns me when we keep making these statements that it's an improvement, but we really don't have the data. And I say that as a matter of record because I'd like somebody to produce some evidence for me that it will improve it. That being said, I'm not meaning to oppose your bill, but I just want to reflect on one concern. And this is one that I think for me was very logical, and I like to see things stand to basic logic because human nature often generally comes to play. If I understand this correctly, the design build process in Subdivision 5 is a process that where we will determine whether or not an entity is qualified to submit a bid, and then they can submit a bid. Is that correct?
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, I'm going to defer to Mr. Cutchell on that because I think he can speak expertly to this process.
Mr. Cutchell.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, on the...
bill.
Oh, it's in the bill? Oh, I'm sorry. Is that... Okay, that's qualification-based. The way it works in the qualifications base is the State Designer Selection Board sends out a request for qualifications. Anyone who wants to can submit their qualifications. What they do then is evaluate the qualifications and create a short list of 3 to 5 firms or joint ventures or whatever this looks like to go on and be interviewed to be selected for the project. This is very similar to the way that architects and engineers are selected in the state right now. This is the process. The only thing that is happening right now is that the constructor is being added as a part of the team as a professional service provider. So it's pretty much the identical process that the State Designer Selection Board uses right now for architects and engineers.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and forgive me, your name, sir?
Bob Cutchell.
Cutchell?
Cutchell.
Cutchell. Thank you for that response. Now I know some concerns with the current process. Let's look at line 17.
Are you on page 11?
Page 11.
Bill. 11 of the bill.
Page 11 of the bill, line 17. Evaluating qualifications in an open, competitive, and objective manner. Then it goes on, the criteria and subcriteria shall include, but are not limited to, the proposer's experience. That's not subjective. Including capacity of key personnel, that is subjective. Technical competence, that's subjective. Capability to perform, that is subjective, unless you take that to mean the following statement, the past performance of the proposer and its employees as a constructor or primary designer. That's not subjective. I find it difficult in seeing that this is a really open and competitive process when there's so many subjective things mentioned in determining one's qualifications. And it really troubles me because this is what logically I had concerns about, and then when I see it written this way, it really concerns me that, and now you're telling me, Mr. Kutchel, that we already have this going on, and I have a lot of concerns with the concurrent process, and this is helpful to possibly identify them, but this concerns me in the bill because this is not competition if we are selecting those who are going to submit bids and let them compete, and we could have an agreement that, well, there's no way to know if we really have cost savings. If we're going to select those who are submitting bids on this basis, on subjective criteria, we could very easily select proposers that will never really be competitive, and they'll just make sure they have work. And all of those who would be competitive and bring the cost down will be gone.
Mr. Kutchel.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson. What you are selecting in this process is professional service providers. The vast bulk of the actual work that is going to be done under that delivery process is competitively bid to subcontractors. A typical building project for a general, I work for Ryan Companies, a typical building project for us, 85 to 90% of the work that is actually done on a project is done by subcontractors. All of that work gets competitive bid out in this process. All you're selecting when you select a design builder under the qualifications-based selection method is you're selecting the architect, the engineer, and the constructor basically to provide design and management of the process. They may or may not, if the design builder wants to do any of the work, they have to competitive bid it against anybody else who wants to do it. So this process assures substantial competitive bidding throughout the project. It's anywhere from, I would say, 85 to 95% of the work is going to be competitive bid to anybody who wants basically to bid it.
Madam Chair, begging your pardon, Mr. Kutchel, then I go back to my first question. Because I thought I had a confirmation from you. Is it not a process where we evaluate qualifications, and if they don't meet our qualifications, they cannot submit a bid? Is that correct?
Mr. Kutchel.
Mr. Kutchel.
Are we talking about the selection of a design builder or subcontractors who would perform work on the project? I need a clarification on that.
Representative Olson.
Well, I would want the question to apply to either one, Mr. Kutchel. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Kutchel.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, on the selection of the design builder, it is based upon the qualifications of the team. And there is a shortlisting process. There's an interview process. And again, you're hiring a professional service provider, and this is done in the same fashion as it is for architects and engineers. When it comes to the subcontractor part of this, there will be some type of qualification process in there so that not everyone, people will need to be able to bond the project. We're concerned about safety record. Mm-hmm. We're concerned about whether they follow state and federal employment law. If they have a history of breaking laws, we don't particularly want them on the project. So there is a bit of a qualification process there, but the intent is to have free and open competitive bidding of people who are capable of doing the project and doing it well.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the time on this because I think this is very, very important. Because my understanding, Mr. Kutchel, with all due respect, you've confirmed my concern. And I just want to try to clarify it because let's put it in terms that I'm familiar with and I think everybody here is familiar with as well, more of a general contracting. Talking about like a general contractor. And I'm a subcontractor. Let's say. And so in this scenario, I have a general contractor that's not been approved by the state. But I'm a good subcontractor, and the general contractor that's been approved by the state doesn't need me. So I can't get access. I can't put forth a bid. Now, that's fine for a subcontractor, but my point is, We're talking about needing to get, as a general contractor, needing to get approval of the state, from the state, before they can submit a bid, that's open and competitive with regard to getting that approval from the state, but it's not open and competitive with regard to submitting bids on the project. When you have, I go to my next point, which I've already made once, but I'm trying to connect the dots here. I go to my next point, where the criteria is listed here is very subjective, including capacity of key personnel. Why not including qualifications of key personnel? Instead of technical competence, why not technical expertise? Capability to perform. Who decides capability to perform? All these guys are in business. Somebody must have determined they're capable of performing. It's the past performance of the proposer that has more teeth to it and is less subjective. And my concern is to have open competitive evaluations of the qualifications as it's written in line 17, the subjective criteria is problematic. That's the point I'm trying to get at. Now, I do have concern of the process, which I now know exists already, and I think is problematic already, and now we're using it again, but here we have subjective criteria for evaluating qualifications in an open and competitive way. That concerns me. It seems very problematic.
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, I don't know that I can answer Representative Zolson's questions other than to note his comments and to say that the language we have here is pretty much lifted from years and years of current practice with the State Designer Selection Board and others in trying to find qualified people to apply. So I noted, and I guess we move on.
Madam Chair, final comment.
Thank you.
I've been around road contractors indirectly for many years, and I've seen strong evidence in this state that there are certain road contractors that are prospering and prospering and prospering, and I know of evidence where they're getting contract after contract after contract to this state and have had strong connections to this state, and there are other contractors that are just as qualified, and they don't get that access. And now I know that we have this current process, and now I know we're going to perpetuate this current process, and this, to me, can actually eliminate true competition.
Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, I could go very far with that one, but I decline. Yeah.
Thank you. Now, I do have four members on the list, and we have two other bills listed. I will extend our committee meeting today until 12:15, and I want to make sure we get Representative Wilkins' bill up, because there is several people in the audience for that bill. We may end up moving Representative Hoppe's bill to next week, but four other members, if you could keep your questions concise here, and hopefully we can get a vote on this one today. Next up is Representative Hoche.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple questions for clarification. In the bill, the commissioner referenced many times. I'm assuming that's the Commissioner of Commerce, because it's not defined.
Representative Beard.
No, Madam Chair, Representative Hoche, that's the Commissioner of Administration who's charged with opening all these contracts. Okay, should that be
defined? Representative
Hoche. Thank you, Madam Chair. Should that be defined in the bill? It's not defined in any matter.
Mr. Kutchel.
Madam Chair, Representative Hoche, I can't see your name there. The Commissioner has defined with each of the different public entities that is using this. If it's the Department of Administration, the Commissioner is the Commissioner of Administration. If it's the University of Minnesota, the Commissioner means the Board of Regents. If it's MNSCU, it's the whatever the governing board is at MNSCU. I don't know what it is. So the Commissioner means really three different things depending on which public entity is using this these different delivery methods.
Representative Hoche, we have a clarification from Mr. Shepherd on that.
Madam Chair and members, and Representative Hoche, the term commissioner is defined on page 4, lines 17 to 19 of the bill, and it would be that would be applicable for all of the sections in the rest of the bill.
Thank you.
It's in the rest of the bill.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Hoche.
Thank you, Mr. Shepherd, and thank you, Madam Chair. A couple more things. The 5-10% requirement, is that by agency or by institution? I mean, is that a requirement for MNSCU, or does it go as far down to the local level, such as the individual university itself?
Mr. Kutchel.
Madam Chair, Representative Hoche, it's for each institution. Would be the university would have their pool of projects, MNSCU, and admin. There'd be three different pools of projects.
Representative Hoche.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One last question, and I'll make it quick. For the job order contracting, for the opening of for qualifications, is that open all the time for contractors to submit to get on that list, or is that just through the determination of the commissioner?
Mr. Cutchell.
Madam Chair, Representative Holch, I believe that would be left up to the agency to manage that process. I is that correct? And you do it periodically throughout the year, or how do you...
We need to have him up the mic here, yeah.
Sorry.
Please come up and identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Michael Perkins, Associate Vice President of Capital Planning, University of Minnesota. The way we have used that in the past is we have put contracts out for a specified period of time, say 4 years. And now we are in a position where we are doing it on an annual basis.
Okay. Next step, we have three more members. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I actually, I'm going to go back to a point that Representative McNamara made, and I've got some other questions, but I'll talk to Representative Beard about these before they come to the floor.
Thank you.
But we were talking, we both have concerns about the...
are you looking at a certain page?
I'll get to that in just a second here, because I got to find the right name I'm going to call it. The qualified kind of construct, where they go for the $250,000 job order contracting on page 22, line 6, and then it is, I'm actually working off of page 6, line 34, where you get to the point under your authority on line, on page 6, line 34, you say, and it's number 3, select a contractor by a job order contracting delivery method as provided in section 16C.35. On the page 7, you are actually talking about the percentages that you can put this into effect for. You know, the 5% in fiscal years 6 and 7 and 10% thereafter. Now, it would seem to me the way this is written is that job order contracting would come underneath those limitations. Was that your intent, or is it just I'm reading it wrong, Representative Beard?
Representative Beard, who's going to answer that one? Representative Beard.
Madam Chair and Representative Mahoney, no, that was not the intent of the sponsors of the bill. They wanted job order contracting, I think, to be a tool that could be used quite flexibly, and the 5 and 10% would only apply to design, build, and construction manager risk.
Well, in the interest of time, I'll talk to you after the committee hearing and before it gets to the floor. I got a couple other questions, too.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question maybe for the chair or for the members to consider. Yesterday in a different committee, we had a bill that we weren't happy with completely. We wanted to pass it, but we didn't like it in the form it was. And since it was going to the general register and not another committee where you can fix it, we voted to lay it over and make sure it was fixed. And I understand that this is going to the general register. It sounds like there's some problems with this bill that we're not all agreed on. I know that the Senate has got their bill to hear, just like in the situation yesterday, same thing. If we don't send over a bill we think is in pretty good shape, when it goes to conference committee, we're trusting the Senate to put things in their bill that we would like to see, and maybe that won't happen, and so the good parts of what we think should be in the bill married up with the good parts that they think is in the bill won't all be there because we sent over an imperfect bill. So you might want to consider fixing it again and bringing it back.
Representative Wardle, let's get a response from the author here. Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, I appreciate sensitivities from Representative Wardle, but I don't think other than two persistent lines of questioning that I hear that there's problems with the bill. It is a complicated bill, difficult one to understand easily, but I don't think it's necessarily a threatening bill to anybody's way of doing business other than to allow an additional tool in the toolboxes of these three government agencies that perform an enormous amount of our bonding work. Now, Representative Olson's concerns aside about subjectivity and in the selection process, which I submit is way outside the scope of this bill because it involves the entire section of law regarding government procurement for the entire state. That's a whole other issue, and I would beg that you don't drag this bill into that process just now. But beyond that, Representative Wardle, I don't hear that there's grave concerns, just that there are an enormous amount of very intelligent questions about a very complicated subject. However, I do stand, of course, at the will of the committee.
Representative Wardle.
I'll let the committee decide. I just wanted to make sure that thought process was brought out.
And Madam Chair, I think you remembered just a few weeks ago, used the layover for further consideration process in respect to the sensibility of this committee.
Mm-hmm.
I'm aware of that. Thank you, though, for the offer.
I'd like to see how we can go here the next few minutes and maybe decide. Representative Neil Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to give some personal experience because I want to weigh in and support this bill. Design build, I have used personally in my own life and in construction. I've used it for 20-some years because it's a preferred way of doing business in the development projects we do for families. But design build is also used in very, very complex construction, and it is preferred in very complex projects because you can bring in the horsepower you need. The classic example was the Mall of America. I was intimately involved. There were five design build projects going on simultaneously for each of the four department stores and for the superstructure. And the city of Bloomington had given a development agreement to allow that to happen because they knew there was not, you couldn't get anybody to design it. There was nobody that could design it. And then if you tried to bid the design, you were going to have to go back and redesign it because it was so complex. And so the requirement is these five design build contractors would come into the room every Monday and they would all agree how they were going to bring this superstructure out of the ground. 4 million square feet, almost $1 billion. And I know the questions you're going through. I know the questions we went through 10 years ago on this same subject, and is it fair, and how do you select, and is everybody being cut out? But I assure you, in that bag of tricks, that it will probably be more appropriate to use this when the project is extremely complex because you can put the horsepower to it, and in many cases, it comes out more financially advantaged because you can sit in the room and these other people are saying, wait a minute, this something's wrong with this number. You can do that in design build better than at any other time, and it's totally appropriate. I would just assure the commission this has been done in the industry for many, many years, and we as a state, by not allowing it, are still in the dark ages in some of the things we're doing.
Okay, I have two members with questions. Next up, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and appreciate the discussion very much. Representative Pearson, I really agree with you. I've been a builder for over 25 years, sole proprietor, small operation. Every single project I've ever had problems with, I had nothing to do with the design. But when I was responsible to design it and build it, we found those problems before they were built. And not to say we didn't make mistakes in designing, but we found them before they were built.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I look at the definition here, I concur with you fully. Definition of design build: owner contracts with a single entity perform both the design and construction of a project under a single contract. It makes sense. But Representative Beard, what I commented on was not necessarily just current law. It's in this bill. And I really wanted a yes or no answer from Mr. Kutchel. And I think I got a confirmation, but this process that is subjective is really troubling to me because in my experience with road contractors through our township and the state activity in the area, given that, you know, I don't want to expound upon all my connections, but it's not necessary, but I've been exposed to some contracting with the state level as well as the local level. And I see this process, now that I know this is actually in place, I see this process bringing us closer and closer to fewer and fewer options. And I can see why. Because I can see that if you go to page 13, the commissioner is outright deciding who can submit a bid as a general contractor. Now, the design-build part is great, but to subjectively decide who can submit these bids logically and inherently is going to take us down the path of fewer options of contractors able to submit the bids. Certain contractors will be weeded out. If it's done subjectively, it's not good. If it's done meritoriously, it's great. And I think we got a lot of problems here, and I concur with Representative Wardlow's comments. I'm always happy to work with people. This process is much too fast. You can identify mild concerns with the bill, but I would submit there's very few members in this committee who probably read this bill word for word.
Representative Beard.
Well, Madam Chair, the years of discussion and work that went into producing this, I mean, it's not the first time this has been in front of us, and certainly 42 other states have figured out how to work with this, and this bill is modeled after those that experience. There's a vast body of experiences that have done before. The Association of General Contractors is one of the prime sponsors of this bill, and that is, I believe, an association that encompasses an enormous amount of general contractors, subcontractors, and prime contractors in this state. Their own membership did not have this problem that's being expressed by Representative Olson. Now, I understand the concerns about shutting people out in some sort of a qualification process, but given the openness of the process, the openness of the system, I'm failing to see how abuses could go undetected, and there certainly is recourse here if there is abuse going on. Even within, let me just limit my comments to that, unless our friends from AGC have any comment that would buttress it or reflect on the comments.
Madam Chair, just one point from the perspective of an architect who has been involved with the State Designer Selection Board for a number of years. That board itself is a public agency. It has members on it that represent a diversity of all of the different people that are involved in a construction building project. And I think it's that size of that group, its deliberations are public and open to the public. I think that does, while you're saying some of the criteria might be subjective, at least the cross-section of those folks involved in making that determination, I think, are what makes it effective. And it's been that way for 30 years.
And again, if, Madam Chair, the qualifications thing don't concern me as much. And in fact, I hope we do it, because I certainly am not going to, if we got a paving project, I wouldn't want the U of M to have Representative McNamara's landscaping firm at the table. That would be counterproductive, just for instance. I think we shouldn't fear the pre-qualification process at all. Depending on the project that's being bid, I think the system itself, the process itself, is wired towards openness and competence. I do have Mr. David Semerod from AGC who would like to comment to this concern also, if I may.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, Dave Semerod. I'm the CEO for Associated General Contractors in Minnesota. We participated as part of the coalition establishing this legislation with the other coalition members. And while we recognize that there are some issues that have already been identified, our board of directors does support the bill. So we took probably 9 months in the process, but we are supportive of it. So.
Okay, next up, Representative Houston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Beard, I had the honor of working in the military during the time frame of the $800 toilet seat. I think some of you remember that, and the $500 hammer. And it was shortly after that we saw some significant reforms and acquisition reform in the military, some of that which led to what we're talking about here today, design-build reform. And it has made some huge implications in terms of how acquisition throughout the military is taking place, and put to better use the taxpayer dollar in terms of not just monies, but in terms of efficiencies. I really see this as a move that we need to take. You know, it's a small move in terms of 5 to 10% of the contracted, and it's an area that brings some accountability to government, brings some good competition. I think, you know, it sounds like there's been a lot of great minds that have been working on this thing for a while. We could, as we do down here so often, legislate through, you know, some of the verbiage and just crunch on this until it's powder. I don't think we necessarily need to do that. I think this is a good move, and I would say thanks for bringing this bill forward and strongly support it.
Okay, I'd like to get a vote on this bill. Just want to make sure that if there's anybody else from the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill. Okay, Representative Beard renews his motion that House File 1460, as amended, be recommended to pass to the General Register. Excuse me. Any discussion? All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and the bill goes to General Register. Thank you, Representative Beard. Okay, we will be meeting until 12:15 today, and we'll be moving Representative Hoppe's bill to next week. Next up is Representative Wilkins' bill, and I understand he'll be here shortly. We do need to be out of the room by about 12:15 or so. If there's anybody in the audience that wants to testify for or against this bill, if you could let us know now. I understand the author is in the middle of a vote in another committee. Representative Seibert, you're a co-author on the bill. I understand you're going to make the initial motion here. Representative Seibert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File Number 980 on behalf of Representative Wilkin with recommendation to pass, and be referred back to House Policy and Finance.
Okay, Representative Seibert, so the motion is to go to Health Policy and Finance. Okay. And still waiting for Representative Wilkin. I know that there are two amendments. Representative Seibert, are you aware of anything with the two amendments?
Madam Chair, we might be able to help you with the amendments.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Joel Yulin. I'm from the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, Minnesota chapter. I think as far as the amendments go, we were only planning to do the A3 amendment.
Okay.
And that was what we discussed with Representative Wilkin.
Okay. Chair will move the A3 amendment. And Mr. Yulin, would you like to tell us a little bit about the A3 amendment?
Sure. Would you like me to just do my testimony? Just about 2 minutes.
Now. Oh, here he is. Representative Wilkin. Representative Seibert has moved your bill to health policy. We're looking at the A3 amendment. I just moved it. And I don't know if you want to tell us a little bit about the A3 amendment. Is that to put the bill in the shape that you would prefer?
Yeah, I support it in whatever these guys say.
Okay. Any discussion on the A3 amendment to put the bill in the order that the author prefers? Okay. All in favor of the A3 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Wilkin, your bill is before us as amended. Please present it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is the Minnesotans with Disabilities Act for 2005. The piece that brought it to your committee was exactly what was amended. Specifically, the working group for the various agencies and the interested parties to work on basically coordinating issues of housing and such. We've been working on something that's a little more workable, I guess you'd say, for these groups in getting the job done. Instead of having a very prescriptive membership listed for this organization we're setting up in statute, it's more of a an invitation rather than a summons in statute. So we get the groups that want to work on these issues together to come up with some proposals. Is that put it in a nutshell?
Okay, and the section of this bill that we're looking at, Mr. Shepard?
Madam Chair, members, as Representative Wilkin indicated, the section that caused this bill to be referred here to the Governmental Operations Committee is the section in the A3 amendment. His amendment took out the other section of the bill that was relevant.
Thank you. Questions to the bill as amended? Representative Khan.
Madam Chairman and Representative Wilkins, or maybe Mr. Shepard, see, we took out a commission
and he put in a working group, so that a working group doesn't have any of the strictures and statute that might deal with commissions and so forth. Is there any, can someone tell us what happens with this working group? Does it get paid per diem? Does it get expenses? Does it get does it have any expiration time?
Representative Wilson.
And does it have any, who appoints it? Kind of a fuzzy thing.
Representative Wilson.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, it kind of expires when the recommendations are due in October 15th, 06. And this is modeled on...
Say that.
It's on the last line of the, or the second page at the end, subdivision 3.
Where does it say that?
Line 19,
page 2 of the amendment.
Yes, it says it will be submitted, but it doesn't... I don't read that it says that the working group... Fires at that time.
If Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, if you'd like to amend to say that it disappears at that date, that's fine.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
That's the intent.
That's actually not a very good intent, because you really want it. You know, you submitted the recommendations. I assume these groups may want to hear it. So you might want someone around to hear it afterwards. I mean, I think what you want is you want something that takes this section of the statute out at some point.
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. John Chuda from Courage Center and co-chair with Mr. Ulanda of the Minnesota Consortium of Citizens with Disabilities. In drafting this, Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, we modeled it after other successful groups like the Long-Term Care Commission that had addressed senior concerns a couple of years ago, which did not have an expiration date in statute but was assumed to be a temporary commission or working group for the purposes of bringing recommendations to the legislature. That would also be our intent with this group. It would not be subject to the other requirements of the commission and the per diem, but would be a temporary working group for the purposes of formulating those recommendations and bringing them forward and following them through the legislative process.
Representative Kahn.
Well, what happened with the... was that set up with legislation? And what happened to the... what happened to the language that set that up? Is that still in statute, or did it, you know, without anything existing for it, or what?
Mr. Chita.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, I do believe that was rider language that was not codified in statute.
Representative Kahn.
Okay. Mark the finder. So, that's
okay. Further questions, Representative Kahn?
Well, he probably should have said it to the other members of the committee.
Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair and members, just to perhaps clarify that this language will never go into statute. It's a temporary working group, and it won't ever appear in the, won't ever be codified into Minnesota statutes.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Kahn.
Mr. Shepard, could you tell me where I see that in the bill? Where I see that it's a rider as opposed to...
Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn and members, there's no proposed coding of this in Minnesota statutes, and because of that, and because it is temporary in nature, the reviser would not codify it into the statutes.
Okay.
Okay, next up is Representative Dempsey.
I'll pass, Madam Chair.
Okay. Further questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Wilson.
If I could have a member move one minor amendment on page 1, line 7, after Minnesota, put state, that would correct it to...
Chair will move that over that oral amendment. Page 1, line 7, insert state between Minnesota and council. Is that correct?
Yes, and after the word disability there should be just singular.
Okay. That's on line 7. The fourth word in there should be disability, singular. Okay. Everybody get that oral amendment?
Madam Chair, we're talking about the amendment, not the bill. Right?
On the amendment. The A3 amendment. Did you get that? Mr. Shepherd, if you could just repeat it so it's clear to everybody in the committee. Thank you. Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, members, it's on the A3 amendment, page 1, line 7, between the words Minnesota and council, insert state, and then delete the word disabilities and insert the singular disability.
Okay, and I think, do we need a separate vote on this? Okay. All in favor of the chair's oral amendment on line 7, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and amendment is incorporated within the A3. Representative Wilkin.
That's all I have, unless members have questions.
Okay. And is there somebody from the audience? We have about 10 more minutes left in the meeting. If somebody would like to testify for or against this bill. Okay. Representative Wilkin, I'll let you have the final word here before we move your bill.
Just I'd appreciate all your support. This is a work in progress. The groups are very easy to work with, and they've worked with people who had concerns on this area of the bill, and the department is supportive. So we have peace in the valley. It's always nice to have on your bills.
Okay. Representative Seibert renews his motion that House File 980, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Health Policy and Finance. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and bill goes to Health Policy and Finance. Thank you, Representative Wilkin. Members, we could have the room another 10 minutes. What's the will of the committee as far as Representative Hoppe's bill that we had discussion on yesterday?
Take it
up. Thumbs up, thumbs down. Let's see.
Vote it up.
Representative Hoppe, come on up.
Madam Chair and members, I'd be willing to do it. Mr. Bogus left. So if we have technical questions for the DNR, they wouldn't be here to answer them. But we have the new engrossment and Representative McNamara's duck amendment, and those are the only changes from yesterday. Doesn't involve nothing involving rules other than the waterfall/duck provision.
Okay, why don't we bring it up? Representative Hoppe moves that House File 847 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Agriculture Finance. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'll be brief, as I just said before coming up here. We do have one amendment that we talked about in committee yesterday. It is the A050205 amendment. I would move that amendment or let Representative McNamara do it. It's his amendment.
Madam Chair,
members have that amendment.
It was distributed to us.
Okay.
I can actually, it could be done orally if they don't have it in front of them.
Well, I think we have it, right?
Yeah.
205 amendment. Representative Hoppe, you're moving this?
I'll move it, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Hoppe moves the 205 amendment. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my discussions with the DNR revolved around the regular duck season, and inadvertently it got printed as the migratory waterfowl, which would have implications on the early goose season. So it was probably my technical fault. And so this is just to correct that.
Any questions on the 205 amendment? All in favor of the 205 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and amendment is adopted. Representative Kahn.
Did we discuss Section 40 in this bill yesterday?
Representative Hoppe.
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, we did briefly, and the amendment, page 23, line 11, all it is just there was just a misprint, or might not have been a misprint. We might have not caught that, but instead of Section 34, it should be Sections 34 and 35, just to make sure that we cover it everywhere in the bill, in the new language.
Well, Representative Hoppe, is that an oral amendment? What are you talking about?
No, it was included as part of the last amendment, Madam Chair.
Got it. Okay, well, Representative Kahn.
I'm just questioning. I'm just asking because I don't remember it. Did we discuss the section?
Madam Chair and Representative Collins, Mr. Shepherd gave us a nice explanation of the
good cause
exemption.
Okay.
And you were very happy with it.
Okay, we have that on record. Representative Hoppe, how much time did we spend on your bill yesterday? Mm-hmm. About 40 minutes or so?
Yeah.
This seemed pretty thorough.
Well,
Okay. Representative Kahn?
No.
Pass. Other questions from members? Anybody from the audience want to testify for or against this bill? Representative Hoppe, it looks like you're in luck. You want to renew your motion?
Madam Chair, I would love to renew the motion to pass this House File 847 as amended and refer to Environment Finance, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and amendment is passed, or bill is passed in the next committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your patience, understanding, and consideration.
Thank you, members. Just real quickly before we adjourn here, please notice the bills that will be up on Tuesday. Initially, we had talked about doing Representative Powell's Health Powers Act on Tuesday, but the Health Committee wants to see that first. We're thinking potentially we could do that bill on Thursday next week. So we're looking at, for Tuesday, Representative Cypress bill, 1492, Representative Olson's bill, 1172. I believe those are both three referrals, or at least Olson's is. And then Representative Earhart's bill on the salary cap will potentially be on Tuesday. Wednesday would be our military day. We have several bills there. And like I mentioned, Thursday probably the Representative Powell's bill. So please check the website and get your amendments in as soon as you can. With that, members, meeting is adjourned.